Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Glad you're listening to NPR News. This hour, what is the B.1.1.7 COVID variant and other variants that are emerging going to mean for the next 60 days in this pandemic? At the end of January, Dr. Michael Osterholm told NBC it could mean, quote, the darkest days of the pandemic, which I know some of us find confusing because we're all seeing lower case numbers, lower hospitalizations, and lower mortality rates. But of course, we're also seeing reporting on these variants emerging. So as Dr. Osterholm joins us for the hour, I know you have many questions. What do you want to know about how these variants, especially the UK variant, are spreading? Are you wondering about whether there are more variants in the making? And I know you have questions about vaccinations. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach us with questions for Dr. Osterholm on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Dr. Mike Osterholm, Director for the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the U of M, also a member of President Biden's COVID team. And Mike, welcome back. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's good to be back with you. Thank you.
So I have to admit, I saw your appearance on Meet the Press on January 31st saying the darkest days of the pandemic could be ahead. And I was pretty shocked. I mean, 18 days have passed. A lot has happened. How are you feeling about that now?
I'm more convinced that that's actually the case. I think right now what we're seeing is basically the lull before the storm. I liken it in a sense to imagine we're all sitting on this beautiful sand beach on the Gulf somewhere, blue skies, temperature of 80 degrees, light breeze, not a cloud in the sky. And we're trying to tell people, get ready to evacuate. And everyone is saying, why? This makes no sense. But we can see that Category 5 hurricane 400 miles south of the beach heading straight towards the beach. And that's what these variants represent right now.
Is the Category 5 hurricane specifically the B.1.1.7 because we're hearing that it will end up being the dominant variant or the others that are emerging?
Yeah, it is the B.1.1.7 variant. And maybe just to give a background so people understand that a variant of this virus is just one that has experienced mutations. And they do that all the time. There have been many, many, many variants of the virus since its first emergence. But we have a category of variants called variants of concern, VOCs. And these are viruses that have mutated to do one of three things or a combination thereof. First, do they transmit easier, more widespread than the other viruses would do, more transmissibility? Number two, do they cause more serious illness, including death? And number three, are they able to evade the immune protection that we get from either vaccine or natural infection, and in some cases, even the treatment with the monoclonal antibodies? The B.1.1.7 variant, which some people refer to as the UK variant, which emerged in England, which has now spread to a number of areas in throughout Europe and the Middle East, has those first two characteristics. It surely is much more transmissible, 30 to 70% more transmissible. And it surely is causing more severe disease, including increased deaths and hospitalizations. But it hasn't yet, in a widespread manner, picked up that third characteristic, the one about evading the immune protection. There are just in the last 10 days, several of the B.1.1.7s in England that have been identified there that have acquired that, but they're not spreading widely. And in the United States, the one we're worried about is the B.1.1.7, which now is, in fact, spreading widely here. Just this week, CDC's updated. It's now in 42 different states documented. I'm sure it's in all 50 states. And what we're following right now is almost a similar scenario as we saw in the European countries that have been so hard hit by this virus in terms of, you know, weeks of early transmission where the level appears to be low, but then it picks up very quickly. And if you think about doubling numbers, you know, 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 doesn't mean big changes. But if you start doubling 2,000 to 4,000 to 8,000 to 16,000, those are big numbers. And that's what we're worried about. This virus is following that same path in North America as we have seen in Europe and the Middle East.
Okay, a couple questions about what you've said. I also am reading about this Bristol variant that has also emerged, named for a town in the UK, that also carries some of these characteristics that you've just talked about. It binds more closely to human cells, so it's more transmissible. There's a sense that it might be more resistant to vaccines. I guess more work needs to be done on that. So what are you hearing and understanding about this new variant?
Well, you know, Carrie, for the couple of people on this in this audience who are old enough to remember the 1960s music scene, there was a famous song by the Fifth Dimension called The Age of Aquarius, Let the Sun Shine In.
Uh-huh.
And I have to tell you, day after day after day, and this is happening for the last 6 weeks, I just keep hearing in my head, this is the dawning of the age of the variants. They have fundamentally changed the game with this particular pandemic. And we have to respect them. We have to try to understand what they mean. And I should, by way of disclosure to the audience, some I'm sure will reaffirm this readily, is I actually think I know less about these viruses today than I did 6 weeks ago.
Wow.
The more we learn, the more questions we have about what's going to happen. I haven't even mentioned the other variants, the one you mentioned, but also one called P1 from Brazil or B135 from South Africa, which have acquired part of the one and two characteristics, more transmissibility, more serious illness. But what's really concerning is they've acquired that third bucket of opportunity. In other words, being able to evade the immune protection, at least in, to some degree, from the vaccines or natural infection. So expect we're going to see many, many more variants. There was a confusing article in the media just in the last 2 days about a series of new variants found here in the United States. And the researchers that did the work were absolutely right on target. Their message was correct, but they said these variants aren't causing us any unique problems, meaning that they weren't one of the three buckets. The media took that to mean variants don't cause problems.
Yeah, I
saw that. I just come back to reaffirm some of them are real big problems.
So I heard you loud and clear here on someone who does the kind of work you do and has the expertise is looking at the way these variants are changing. And to be clear, this is not unusual in a virus that variants would emerge. But you're saying you really can't track the path of what these variants will do because they're kind of new beasts to be studied.
Yeah. Well, what's happened is they've acquired an ability to mutate that we haven't seen before. And in fact, in the early days of the pandemic, when we had talked about kind of aging the virus and that it was relatively new into humans, likely having been in animals first, we actually based that on what was at the time some kind of orderly increase in mutations that would occur. Now we're seeing viruses go from, you know, 3 or 4 mutations to 23 mutations, just like that. And so what's happening as the virus is now more in the human population, remember a year ago right now, this virus had hardly even tinged the world at all. I mean, it was not there. And so what's happened is over the course of the past year, particularly as we've had more and more immunity develop in people previously infected, for this virus to survive and actually proliferate, one of the things it wants to do is basically get around that immune protection that our previous infections or vaccines have given us. They didn't have to worry about that a year ago because there was really very few people out there. So we call this basically microbial evolution. The virus is adapting to the conditions, and the problem is the way it's adapting is it's concerning us about our immunity. The second thing is just it's kind of been the survival of the fittest. This B117 is much, much more capable of being transmitted, and that's why we're so concerned that the conditions that we took even 10 weeks ago may not be sufficient to reduce transmission now. Meaning if I went to an indoor air environment and there was some virus in there because somebody was infected, but I had a mask on, I didn't spend as much time in there, I might not have gotten infected. Today, that might be a situation where you would get infected just because of the increased virus. And so that's what makes this so challenging right now. It's not being transmitted any different ways than we see with the previous viruses. It's just that there's more of it. There's more of it in the air. and it's more likely to infect you.
So another question here, and then we'll open it up to calls. When you said the darkest days of the pandemic may be ahead, you said that on Meet the Press, and you're this morning saying, yes, this is what I see. Does that mean darkest days being when we were at the top of these spikes? And when was that? Was that November, yeah. December, January? Is that what this is going to look like in the next 60 days?
Well, let me just give a sense of what we call shifting baselines. It's something I've been trying to help people understand because it really reflects on how they think about where we're at and what's going on.
Okay.
I mean, just quickly, just to think, here we are today at, 75,000 cases reported today, and everybody is feeling really good about that.
Yeah.
75,000 cases a day in July was a house on fire event. But if you go back to the beginning of the pandemic, you know, the first real big peak we saw in the United States was in April, when New York in particular was a hit, but Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, Seattle, Boston, you know, very little even activity in the upper Midwest. We hit 32,000 cases a day, and that was really bad. We got down by late Memorial Day to 20,000 cases, and then the southern states from Southern California to Georgia lit up in July. We went up to 70,000 cases. Remember, 32 was really bad in April.
Yeah.
And then we got back down to 26,000 cases at Labor Day. And in fact, I was on Meet the Press shortly after that, and I said, I thought we'd hit 200,000 cases by Thanksgiving. People thought that was crazy. Boy, you ought to have seen my email.
I'm sure.
On November 20th, we hit 200,000 cases. Then we came back down to 160,000 cases in mid-December. But then look what happened in early January. We hit 300,000 cases. And so what you see is a curve line here where the number of cases just keep going up and up and up for the highs and the low, the basements. And so what I'm concerned about is we're in one of those decreasing case number times, which is great. Mm-hmm. None of us want to see anybody get infected, sick, or hospitalized, or die. So listen, we have to celebrate this. But what this has done is given us this false sense of security we've won. If you just think about this, right now we're loosening up everything.
Right.
Governors and mayors are under such pressure to loosen up everything. When you look at vaccine, it's coming. And it's in right now with the B117s, this vaccine will work. But we're not going to have nearly enough in time. Our studies at SIDRAP have shown that if we keep up the current vaccine efforts we're doing now, by the end of March, we will still have 30 million out of 54 million persons in this country over age 65 who have not had a drop of vaccine. 30 million. Those people are going to be at high risk for this virus, and I think it's going to take off in early to mid-March, and we're going to see that next big peak, and it will carry very, very possibly exceed what we saw in January.
Yeah. Dr. Michael Osterholm with us this morning with some sobering information here and sobering science about what lies ahead in mid-March, even as he acknowledges we're seeing lower case counts and lower death numbers and lower hospitalizations. But if you heard his analogy at the beginning of the conversation, it is like sitting on a beach and watching a Category 5 hurricane approach and having the instrumentation to be able to detect what's coming. I mean, that is what science is doing, and that's what they see as these variants, particularly this B117 UK variant, emerge. So calls and questions for Dr. Osterholm about vaccinations, about these variants, about the virus on the whole, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieMPR to Patrick in Woodbury. Hi, Patrick. I really appreciate you waiting.
Thanks for taking my call. So we have a year's worth of data. Here in Minnesota, we're talking about 90% of the deaths are 65 and older, right? So even if the vaccine is not 95% effective, what are we going to do to protect the 65 and older? I feel like we are wasting a lot of money on things other than saving the lives of 65 and older. 90% of the deaths are there. We don't have a pandemic because a 31-year-old essential worker has COVID. It's because 65 and older are dying.
Okay, so, Pat, I think we have the essence of what you're asking. Yeah. Dr. Osterholm, how would you answer that?
Yeah, well, let me give a couple of points, because actually Patrick raises a very important issue here. And it's an issue that I've also been kind of on the tip of the spear, you might say, right now nationally. Because when you look at the initial trials we did with these vaccines, the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine, they were really designed to get as early a possible result, meaning that the second dose was given 3 weeks or 4 weeks after the first dose. In many other vaccine trials, we would have waited several months to give a second dose, because the immune system continues to mature over time after you've had one vaccine. I mean, look at our routine vaccines, how they are spaced out. When you look at that issue, you can say, well, it's working though. And that's what it got it approved. By the week before the second dose, both vaccines very much appeared to be in that 90 to 95% level of protection already, which is remarkable. And so the question is about the second dose, which I believe everyone should get. Everyone should get it at some time. And the question is, do you need to get it at 3 and 4 weeks? Because if we could go to a single dose now with a second dose later, meaning in the spring, when we will have much more vaccine, we could extend the vaccination substantially. And our group will be coming out with a paper very shortly, which we've actually looked at all of the single dose versus double dose. And we've called for the advisory community immunization practices at the CDC to have an emergency consideration of, does one dose provide enough protection that you can really still reduce illness, hospitalization, and death, and then extend the amount of vaccine we're going to have? We're right now at about 1.7 to 2 million new doses a day, and that's not going to accelerate through March. So we're going to leave these very highly vulnerable people. Nationwide, it's 80% of the deaths occur in 65 years of age and older. So I'm pushing for that consideration right now, which I know will be confusing. I would not want anyone who's already had a first dose, who wants their second dose, to get it. They should get it. Mm-hmm. We're talking about new people. But let me just add one other complexity to that. Right now, we have about 24 million Americans who have had one dose, who need their second dose. Well, let's just do simple math here. If it's 1.7 million to 2 million a day, how many days would it take just to cover second doses of production for that group of 24 million? You could do the next basically 15 days and not give one single first dose. So we've got to look at what can we do in this short period of time before these virus take off in this particular variant. Let me just add one other point, which was very sobering. You saw the announcement yesterday. It was formalized. We were aware of it coming out. And that is the fact that last year in this country, we lost 1 year of life expectancy.
That's
which
just
is
remarkable.
Huge.
Yeah.
That we have not done that since World War II. If you look at it in the Black community, there we saw actually 2.7 years of life expectancy lost. In the Latino community, 1.9 years of life lost relative to life expectancy before. That gives you a sense of what COVID has done. HIV didn't do that. None of the other, the influenza pandemic of 2009 didn't even come close. So it gives people the sense this really is a serious problem. So my goal and what we're pushing is, what can we do with this new surge that is going to happen? I'm convinced of it's going to happen, to keep our hospitals from being overrun and incapable of providing the standard of care that we all agree should be there. Just one last number. If you look at what happened in England, where they started to see this occur in December, and they had to go finally in total lockdown, including their schools, which they had opened. When they were at the height of their hospitalizations in England, if you had looked at the number that they had for their population and extrapolated that to the United States, that would have been about 195,000 hospitalizations a day here. We got to 130,000 hospitalizations in January, and we had ICE intensive care units around the country that were overwhelmed.
That's right.
You saw the pictures of all those semi-trailers out there refrigerated just to handle bodies. Well, now imagine if this hits 195 as opposed to 130. That's what we're up against. So we need to get people protected over 65 years of age more than anyone, just to keep our health care capacity even there to handle the basic everyday challenges of life like heart attacks, strokes, automobile accidents.
Okay. Call here from Philip in Minneapolis. Philip, still on the first and second doses? Is that what you're thinking about?
Yes.
What do you want to know?
I'm wondering who I can contact as a concerned individual. I've been following Osterholm's podcast and following his calls for delaying the second dose until after the B117 surge. Who gets to make that call, and who can I connect with to have my voice heard?
I think this is a good question. Americans who are concerned about this, Dr. Osterholm, what do they do?
Well, the first thing is, and this is what I have continued to stress, and it's been mischaracterized by many, that I'm calling for a study, which if you know anything about a study, that takes months to do. There's a group of us, and in fact, Carrie, one of the people who has been a big supporter of this is a guest that you've had on before with me, Christian Anderson from Scripps, who is one of my dear friends and trusted colleagues, and we're all on the same page on this. Just look at the data. Bring together this advisory communication practices, see what data exists on how well the first dose protects. Look at what's happened in Israel, where they now have extensive data on having brought in the Pfizer vaccine for first dose, second dose. In the midst of Israel has been in lockdown now for weeks because of the severe challenges they've had with B117. And so all we're saying is bring the data together. I'm the first person to say if the data does not support that these people are protected, then, you know, just stick with what we're doing. But if it does indicate that, in fact, people will be protected after a first dose, then we have to immediately move to getting people to be able to, you know, to postpone that dose. By just for the record, I'm not, you know, this is not a big deal other than the fact I walk the talk. I postponed my second dose to next spring. I already had a dose. I was eligible to get my second dose a week ago. And I hope that someone else, 65 years of age and older, who's at risk of dying, maybe it's your grandmother, maybe it's your grandfather, maybe it's your dad or your mom, I hope they got my dose. I feel that strongly about this, that that's what we could do to save thousands of lives over the course of the next 14 weeks.
Yeah, question about that. So you've delayed your second dose. How differently are you living now that you've had the first dose and you have some measure of protection?
Well, as probably many of your listeners would agree with, I don't have a life anymore. It's pretty much a 4 a.m. to midnight shift right now working on this. You know, I used to fly 150,000 miles a year with my work and international. Now I do 150,000 hours of Zoom. So it hasn't impacted my life that much as such, with one exception, and that is the close contact with my family and my grandkids. I can't tell you how painful that is not to be able to wrestle with those grandkids. But that's where we're at right now. And of course, the concern is that they would transmit to me.
So you're,
I feel,
you're
I
not
feel more
seeing
confident
them
right now.
Yet. Mike, or you are?
If I see them, I see them at a distance.
Okay.
You know, it's no up close and personal. I feel the same way about the people I work with. You know, I work with the most amazing team of people at the Center for Infectious Research and Policy. And I see them every day on Zoom, every day. Yet I haven't seen him in person in a year.
Yeah,
that's challenging. That's really challenging.
Call here from Sarah in Fridley. Hey, Sarah, thank you for waiting.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. So my question is, with this surge that's coming, especially here in Minnesota, my concern is, why are we reopening schools?
Yeah.
Why is there such a push to put kids back in classrooms? And I'm not necessarily so concerned with the kids themselves, but with the teachers.
Yeah.
Has anybody even asked the teachers if they want to go back in person? And so how do we balance that, and why is there this push to go back to in-person learning when we're looking at a huge, huge resurgence?
Dr. Osterholm, I'm going to ask you to pause on that for just a minute.
Sure.
We did a show on that yesterday. I want you to hear a little bit of what our teachers had to say. And then, of course, we had the announcement by Governor Wall. So, Dr. Michael Osterholm with us this morning from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. We'll get a look at the latest news. When we come back, we will talk about reopening schools, given what Dr. Osterholm is telling us is ahead in March and April. Okay, right back to the conversation to Dr. Osterholm about schools. Dr. Osterholm, you heard what Governor Walz said yesterday. You heard our caller. What do you think about this idea of getting more kids back into in-person learning?
Well, it is a real challenge in terms of I guess I would call both the risk and the timing. Let me be really clear that what data we have up to now supports the fact that young children, particularly K through 8, we see much, much less risk of transmission in that school setting, either between students or to teachers or teachers to students. And this has been part of the whole age issue. You know, right now in Minnesota, we have two deaths in individuals 20 years of age or younger, which is a tragedy, no doubt about it. But in a given year, we might expect to see anywhere from 4 to 8 deaths from influenza when the schools are operating and not closing down. So from the context of what we look at for serious illness, et cetera, this is a challenge, but it's one that, you know, you balance what we're doing for education and what the risk we have for transmission to teachers. At this point, I think it's a fair call to say we can go ahead. I'm much, much more concerned about the older kids. We have clearly demonstrated ongoing transmission in junior high and high schools. Ironically, some of the most serious problems we've had have been in organized sports and the activities that go on there. My concern right now is that it is going to change quickly. Just like I use the beach analogy, mm-hmm. that gentle breeze is going to give way to heavier winds and pretty soon this Category 5 hurricane. When do you basically make the call to get out of the school mode as such? And that's the challenge. The Brits, those in a number of countries in Europe and Middle East basically made the call after the big surge started. And they did see at that point schools were an important part of the transmission with this B117. So, you know, I've said often, you know, we're really good in this country of pumping the brakes after we wrap the car around the tree.
Yeah.
We have a hard time sometimes getting the pumping done before we never hit the tree. And so that to me is the challenge we have right now. When will we do it? I think as soon as we see increasing cases in Minnesota, that's the time to do everything again. And I know that is going to be very unpopular.
Wow.
I know what it means economically, mental health wise. But I'm telling you also, you've already heard what this B117 has done in countries around the world where it's taken off like it will take off here.
Here's a couple, the view from a couple of teachers who yesterday called in to say that were either back in school or they were ready and willing to go back. First William and then Tyler.
While I do have some anxieties about it, I'm ultimately just excited to get back to it because I did have a one-off in-person experience in Lakeville. I was with kinders and I didn't see a nose. They were all masked up. They were all doing what they're supposed
to
do. They were taking it seriously.
Those guidelines that I think teachers agree are incredibly effective to get people back in class, but are your students going to follow those guidelines and are they going to be enforced in a politically driven environment?
One other question about this, Mike. How important is how the kids are behaving to the safety of the teachers, or is it really more about teacher exposure outside of the schools and not inside?
Well, it's a combination. I don't want to minimize that there can't be exposure to teachers in school. And I surely can tell you that the community is an obvious and clear source. The challenge I think we have right now is, again, the age of the child. The epidemiology of this disease, how it occurs in the population, is much different in younger kids than it is in older kids. And we somehow want to lump them together and say, you know, K through 12 is K through 12, and it's just not. We're seeing differences there. So I can understand distinguishing between, you know, junior high and high school as one approach versus younger kids. And I don't think it's because younger kids are more compliant with masking or distancing. In fact, if anything, being young kids, it's harder to do that. They're just less infectious. We just see less transmission there. And it's something we're going to have to, you know, try to understand over time. But I do think that based on the data we see from Europe and from the Middle East, is when B117 takes off because there's increased transmissibility, that in fact even schools at the youngest ages can contribute to community-wide transmission both between kids and to the teacher. So at that point, I could very easily, I will support that we basically pull back to hybrid at the least, if not distance learning. And I think that that's, you know, I know no one wants to hear that. You know, I want my five grandkids in school and daycare. I want them badly. But I also know that for this next surge of weeks, not years, weeks, you know, this is the right thing to do.
So just, I mean, Governor Walz announced this yesterday for the older kids. Do you think that was too soon?
You know, I have to say that being a governor or a mayor today is one of the worst jobs in the world. You know, you're like a five-pronged shock absorber where you're getting hit from six directions on that five prongs. It's tough. And I understand the issues of kids and education. I understand the issues of concern. You know, I've seen it, you know, the argument has gotten down to teachers' union versus parents' right to have their kids educated. I've had parents come to me begging me to please not support school opening because they're so fearful for the health of their child or them bringing home the virus because grandma lives with them and she would be at serious risk of an infection. So it's all over the map as to what we want. We all agree we want our kids to be educated, not just what they learn, but the socialization. Some kids, you know, have no access to the kind of internet capacity that other kids do. So distance learning sometimes, particularly for younger kids, can be a real challenge. We know that for some kids, the one hot meal they get a day is being in school. So we understand that. The question is, when does it become part of the transmission picture that puts people's lives at risk? And I think now it's probably not in the younger kids, but it will be, I believe, upcoming. And so the question is, how do you unring a bell? How does the mayor or the governor of a given area go back and say, well, I know we just opened all these things up. I know that, you know, that's what we did. Now we've got to pull back. Right now, trying to pull back with these case numbers coming down is like basically, you know, trying to get an elephant through a needle, yeah, you know, the eye of a needle. It's crazy. It won't happen. But unfortunately, that's also going to put us at increased risk.
Call here from Victor in Plymouth. Hi, Victor. Good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thank you. Dr. Osterholm, I was hoping you could reconcile something for me. I study the Johns Hopkins COVID dashboard. Each morning I look at it to see what the case counts are doing, and I'm puzzled as to the two countries, the UK and South Africa, where two of these variants that are so worrisome are emerging from, but their case counts have been dropping rather precipitously over the last 3 to 6 weeks, which I thought was reassuring about the variants, but you're clearly saying otherwise. Could you reconcile that for me?
Well, sure. And the fact that you're looking at that every day, congratulations. You're well informed. Understand that both of them have been in extreme lockdowns. I mean, England, as you know, Boris Johnson, the person who everyone thought would never do that, literally put all of England in an extreme lockdown. So that they've been that way since before Christmas. That hopefully would drive down case numbers, because if you can't have contact with others, there's no way to transmit the virus. And yet you still see it's still elevated. The case numbers are still up. They're just not at the peak. Same thing is true in South Africa and what has happened in Nelson Mandela Bay area, which is where we saw the big flare-up of cases there with that variant there. That one, by the way, isn't necessarily as more infectiousness. There's some increase. The one there in South Africa we're concerned about, though, is how it evades the protection of previous infection and what we've seen in terms of vaccine. So the where you've seen this contained is either complete total lockdown or something like what we've seen right now in Israel, where a combination of extensive vaccination of the population and lockdown combined has been the only thing that's driven these case numbers down.
I follow Dr. Eric Topol. You might be familiar with him on Twitter. Yeah.
We're very close friends.
Okay.
If you saw The Hill this week, he and I actually have a little kitchen cabinet that we've put together between the two of us, and we talk frequently.
Ah, okay. Good to know. So he is asking what seems like a really pertinent question about vaccines. How could the largest healthcare company in the world having done the largest vaccine clinical trials, have so few doses ready for their imminent FDA green light. He's talking about Johnson & Johnson. How could that, do you have some insight on how that could be?
Well, actually, Eric and I talk about that very issue a lot. And by the way, he is, I think, one of the most brilliant clinicians and public health minded people in the country. He's, if not the world, he's at Scripps also in California. And it's unclear how and why they're where they're at with the vaccine issue. As you may have seen, the White House today indicated that if they do get approved in their upcoming review with the FDA, there'll still be only a limited number of doses
right.
coming from the company for the first months.
Right.
Until we see that information, we won't know why or how. I don't understand it either. And I think this is going to be a question that will get asked, what happened? And none of us know.
Okay. Question here about vaccines from Dawn in Minnetonka. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I would like to know how long it takes the vaccine creators to adjust the present vaccines to deal with the variants. And are they going to be able to stay ahead of the new variants?
Yeah, Dawn, that's a trillion-dollar question right now, a really good one that all of us are asking. We know with the messenger RNA vaccines, mRNA vaccines, it may only be a matter of weeks, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to actually add in something to the vaccine that will allow it to still attack the virus that has these mutations that right now are defeating the antibody that we and the immunity that we develop from vaccination. The challenge we have with that is that while the FDA has signaled that they will accept that as a strain change, much like we do with influenza, meaning you don't have to go out and do new, big, extensive studies again, that there'll still be review of it, but it won't be that same extensive period of study like we would to the first time the vaccine's approved. The challenge we have is, so what's the next kind of variant mutation going to be tomorrow? And how often do you have to stay ahead of it? And what does that mean? And one of the challenges we have right now, Carrie, and this is a huge issue that's being missed in all of our discussions about what we call vaccine nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, there are over 210 billion people in this world who are in a country that has not had one drop of vaccine and doesn't appear they're going to get any for some time to come. And a number of people who are in countries where they have some vaccine, but it is so short supplied, most people won't get it. Why is that important? It's not just from a humanitarian altruistic standpoint, but if case numbers continue to grow and we see widespread transmission in low and middle income countries, it threatens us here, our vaccines, because that's where the variants are coming from, is these infections in humans and then being driven by that. And so we could see today a vaccine that appears to work very effectively against the, you know, what we have currently. And because we have suppressed transmission here with our vaccines, it's not a big challenge anymore, but it's going to be a challenge in these other countries. And that virus, I will guarantee, will make it to the United States,
so,
which could threaten our vaccines.
I'm really glad you've mentioned this because I've thought about it when I see the Biden administration purchasing millions more doses of vaccines for Americans, you know, into the summer. And I think, you know, those doses are coming from somewhere, aren't they? Because not that we're actively taking them from a specific country, but that will not be available to those countries that haven't been able to get their vaccines yet.
Well, I actually think that there is some, how should I say it, good intent here. Because right now, if you look at the purchase of vaccine for the United States government, it actually exceeds the amount we need in our country.
Right.
And I know that there are those who are actually actively looking at how we can contribute vaccine to the international use. And so I'm actually confident that's happening. You know, one of the things that gives me great hope in how we're addressing the vaccine issue right now is because one of our own, quote unquote, native sons, you know, Andy Slavitt, who you know well,
yep.
who's been on this show, who was brought in by the White House. Andy is, in my mind, one of the ultimate problem solvers in the world. He's amazing. And he is now working on this issue of vaccines and a temporary appointment at the White House. And I know one of Andy's really important considerations was just the point we were talking about, how do we get vaccine to the rest of the world, not only to the United States. So I'm confident at this point that the discussions about all this vaccine carry, which you appropriately nailed, I mean, we are buying a lot of vaccine, is also going to be there to help this issue that I raised about the rest of the world. But it's still going to be far short. We need to ramp up vaccine production for the world substantially.
I'm seeing some questions that we've already covered pop up on Twitter and through the call. So I want to let you know that Dr. Ostrom has been with us for the hour, and the show will be on our podcast. And if you're wondering about one dose versus second doses and some of the questions about the variants, we covered a lot of that. You can search NPR News with Carrie Miller and you'll find it on the podcast. I want to ask you something about herd immunity before we take another call. We are hearing now Dr. Fauci and other epidemiologists and public health leaders say that we may not be looking at herd immunity until well into 2022. Do you agree with that? And how important is the timing that we hit that herd immunity if a lot of us have been vaccinated?
Well, this is one of those areas that I have to, again, have a disclosure to make. I know less about herd immunity today with this virus than I did 10 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And anybody who doesn't say that, I'd be very careful about taking any more information from them. First of all, when you look at herd immunity, it's a concept, again, of getting enough people vaccinated or having protection from natural disease. And it's like putting immune rods in a big virus transmission reaction. And if you get enough rods in there, you actually slow down transmission substantially in the community. You don't stop it. I kind of liken it in the old days when I'd fly, you know, and we'd be a half an hour out from Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and the pilot would announce we're beginning our descent. You don't land at that moment. You land a half an hour later. Hmm. Well, with herd immunity, the same thing happens. When you start to hit that, all it means is that transmission is being reduced over time. It doesn't mean that it stops. Now, we know for some viruses, you have to get into the 90-plus percent level of people vaccinated or protected from natural disease immunity to have that slowing down happen. For other diseases that are not as effective in transmitting, it can be lower than that. The challenge I have, and why I have to head with humility, I don't know the answer to this, what's going to happen with these variants if they start evading immunity? And what does that mean? If you look at Manaus, Brazil, which is a poster child right now for what I'm talking about, this is a city of 2.5 million people at the headwaters of the Amazon. It's landlocked. You have to either fly in or by boat. They had a serious outbreak of COVID in the late spring and early summer, such that it was such a house on fire that they estimated by the time that the outbreak started to subside that over 75% of the residents of Manaus had been infected. And they actually wrote several papers this summer, which were actually well-received and well-researched, saying we'd hit herd immunity. That's what drove it down. Well, then P1, one of the variants we've been talking about that actually evades immunity, took off in Manaus. And through December and up till now, they're in worse shape now than they were last summer. We're trying to understand that right now. What role did P1 play? We know we have a number of people who had been previously infected with the virus, who had even were tested positive for the virus last summer and spring and summer, who now are infected with this second round. So this is where that curveball comes in. You know, I'd like to tell you herd immunity is 85% or 70%. And once we hit there, we're going to see it stay there. But we don't know. And, you know, if there was anything right now we have to be is open our eyes, and we have to keep looking and looking and looking to anticipate what this virus is going to do. And, you know, I spend most of my waking hours today thinking to myself, you know, what's the next move that this virus is going to make?
So I want to sum up here for people that have gotten into the middle of the show. Again, what we are seeing with this B.1.1.7 variant means more restrictive lives and a spike in cases transmissions, hospitalizations, and mortality coming from mid-March and April. Have I got all that right?
Yeah, you do.
And as difficult as it's going to be to rewind back into more restrictive lives, that is going to be necessary in your view.
You know, it is. And I will say right now, you know, you've been following my predictions on this pandemic since last spring, you know, and we've been pretty close, right on the mark in terms of even, you know, saying in
yes.
Labor Day, we would be at 200,000 cases,
right.
126,000, et cetera. I hope I'm wrong here. I will be the first person to acknowledge that. I will apologize. I will take full responsibility for this. But everything in my 45 years in the trenches of public health tells me this is what's going to happen. And all I can say is I'm here just to tell people there's a lot we still can do about it. You know, we can, in fact, with vaccine, target those who are most likely to be seriously ill, hospitalized, and die. There's a lot we can do to make sure that we don't let transmission get blown out of control because of all the things we're now doing, opening up. I mean, we're at the very worst time, we're opening up. I mean, it's that beach analogy I just used. I feel like people are trying to put together a 3-day festival, you know, and the hurricane's, you know, 3 days away. And so I think that's where we're at. And I will come on this show and apologize profusely if I'm wrong. But I'm telling you right now, nothing tells me that's going to be the case. I wish it were.
Well, I would say I look forward to talking with you again in March, Mike, but I don't know, given what you're talking about, it sounds like it may be a difficult conversation. But I really appreciate your willingness to be on and the time you spend with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is an epidemiologist and director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!